Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do a couple chapters, chapter 23 and chapter 24, concerning Jews and finance from Henry Ford's Unabridged, The International Jew, which, as you may know if you've been listening to our series, which you can find at vnnforum.com, is 80 chapters, 4 volumes, The Complete Unabridged, The International Jew, one of the biggest studies ever taken, certainly to its time, of the Jewish question in America, published back in 1920. Jews have been streaming into the country after 1880 and were becoming a big problem back at that time. So he commissioned his researchers at the Dearborn Independent, his paper there in Michigan, to study the question. And these are the best of the articles they did, collected into a 4-volume set. Now very hard to find because the Jews made it disappear and they threatened Ford legally after he came out with it. But there's very valuable information in them. And today we're going to do chapter 23. We're going to do in this session chapter 23, Jew versus non-Jew in New York finance, and then chapter 24, the high and low of Jewish money power. So let's get to it. Epigraph to chapter 23, special dispatch to the Evening Telegram, a change in the Thanksgiving proclamation, Harrisburg, November 10th. So sort of like a press release. An important change has been made in the Thanksgiving proclamation. In the last paragraph, the words Christian Commonwealth have been changed to read a Commonwealth of Free Men. This change has been made because of animadversions made by prominent Israelites. Government Hoyt says that he used the word Christian in the sense of civilized and not particularly in a religious sense. So they're whining because they're a tiny minority, but the minority is right when it's Jews and the majority is wrong when it's whites. Jews talk about minority rights where whites are the majority, and they talk about majority rights where whites are a minority. That's from, anyway, that epigraph is from volume or that special dispatch to the Evening Telegram, a change in the Thanksgiving proclamation is from volume 20, American Jewish Historical Society, quote, documents regarding the Thanksgiving proclamation of Governor Hoyt of Pennsylvania, in parentheses, 1880. So they're barely in the country, and they're already telling people that they can't use the word Christian. And Christians are putting up with it. Jew versus non-Jew in New York finance. The Jewish problem in the United States is essentially a city problem. It is characteristic of the Jews to gather in great numbers, not where land is open, nor where raw materials are found, but where the greatest number of people abide. This is a noteworthy fact when considered alongside the Jews' claim that the Gentiles have ostracized them. The Jews congregate in their greatest numbers in those places and among those people where they complain they are the least wanted. The explanation most frequently given is this: the genius of the Jews to live off people, not off the land nor off the production of commodities from raw material, but off people. Let other people till the soil. The Jew, if he can, will live off the tiller. Let other people toil at trades and manufacture. The Jew will exploit the fruits of their work. That is his peculiar genius. If this genius be described as parasitic, the term would seem to be justified by a certain fitness. In no other city of the United States can the Jewish problem be studied with greater profit than in the city of New York. There are more Jews in New York than in all Palestine. The communal register of the Jewish Kehillah, or Kahal, of New York sets the population at about 1,527,778. Quote, the next largest Jewish community in the world, that of the city of Warsaw, is estimated to have between 300,000 and 330,000 Jews, about one-fifth as many as we estimate for New York. Communal Register, 1917-1918. If we accept the estimate of the number of Jews in the world as about 14 million, one Jew out of every 10 resides in New York. As a population, the Jews exert more power in New York than they have ever exerted during the Christian era in any place, with the exception of the present Russia. The Jewish revolution in Russia was manned from New York. The present governor of Russia was transported almost as a unit from the Lower East Side of New York. The New York ghetto has long since overflowed the Lower East Side. Brownsville, Brooklyn, is a Jewish town with its own language, theaters, and press. The Upper East Side of New York is practically in large sections a Jewish ghetto. The prosperous West Side and the middle-class section of the city north of Central Park are practically Jewish. With the exception of one great department store and a few lesser ones, all the large department stores in New York are Jewish. Men and women's ready-to-wear apparel, laundries, furriers, the general run of shopkeeping is practically monopolized by Jews. The legal profession is predominantly Jewish. It is estimated that of the 27,000 newsstands that control the distribution of New York's reading matter, 25,000 are in the hands of Jews. There are 360 synagogues on the east side of New York alone. The New York Kehillah is a very powerful organization whose membership strength is not accurately known. It may be described as the Jewish government of that city. It was organized in 1908 as the result of a statement by General Bingham, the police commissioner of New York, which then amounted to that the Jewish population, which then amounted to 600,000, contributed 50% of the criminals of the city. The Kehillah is the bar before which the authorities must answer for statements or acts touching the Jewish community. Its power is very great and its methods far-reaching. Politically, while the rest of the country is entertained with the fiction that Tammany Hall rules the politics of New York, the fact is rarely published that the Jews rule Tammany. But it, and that would be parallel to the way they portray the Italians as running the mob when it's more Jews. The Jew mob is stronger than the Italian mob, and the corrupt Irish politics is not as strong as the Jews. But it is not the possession of power that constitutes an indictment of any people. It is their use or misuse of it. And if the fact of the power is established, no misuse of it being found, the fact has a commendatory side. If the Jews who flock to New York become Americans, and if they do not work ceaselessly to twist Americanism into something else, if they strengthen the principles and traditions of America, and do not cease to vitiate the one and abolish the other, the judgment upon them must be one of friendship. However, to establish the fact of Jewish power, one need not remain in the ghetto, nor in the mercantile districts. There are higher fields awaiting survey. In Wall Street, the Jewish element is both numerous and powerful, as might be expected of a race which, from its early days, has played an important part in the financial operations of the world. That is not to say, however, that Jewish influence in American financial affairs is paramount. At one time it threatened to be, but American financiers have always been silently aware of the international Jewish financier and have endeavored quietly to block his game. Time and again, the contest seemed to turn in favor of the Jew, but when the widespread secret wrestlings of the two powers have been suspended for a moment, it has been found that American finance has maintained its superiority, if only in the slight degree. The Rothschilds were the first to be beaten on American soil. The story of their hidden hand in American finance, politics, and diplomacy is a voluminous one, but even their finesse did not avail against the sterling worth of American business. Not, quote, American business, unquote, as it has come to be known, now that thousands of Jews are scattered about the world, representing themselves to be American businessmen, although they can hardly speak English, but American business is represented by the combination of American ability and American conscience. If the reputation of American business has suffered, it is because something other than American methods have been used under the American name. In the New York financial district, Jewish finance makes itself felt through its private banking institutions. As distinct from the great trust companies and banks of deposit, the private banker utilizes his own capital and that of his partners and associates. Jewish finance differs radically from non-Jewish finance in the fact that Jewish bankers are essentially moneylenders. They may underwrite great flotations of bond and stock issues for railroad and industrial companies, governments and municipalities, but these securities are immediately sold to the public. There is a quick money turnover. The public carries the bonds. The Jewish financier gets his money. The Jewish banker himself rarely has a permanent interest in the corporations he finances. Non-Jewish bankers usually feel obligated to retain a connection with the enterprises they have financed in order to assure the investors a proper administration of funds. They feel obligated to contribute to the success of the investments, which they handle for other people. The Jewish banker keeps his capital liquid. The cash is always in his coffers. This is essential to his position as one who deals in money. And when the inevitable day of financial stress arrives, he profits greatly by the higher value then placed on liquid capital. Far and away, the leading Jewish banking house in Wall Street is that of Kuhn Loeb & Company. The head of this great firm was the late Jacob Schiff, whose associates were his son Mortimer, Otto H. Kahn, Paul M. Warburg. These are, again, financiers of the Russian Revolution, the Jewish Revolution in Russia, Schiff, and founders, the main driving force behind the Federal Reserve would be the Paul Warburg, and others who have taken prominent parts in both public life and giant financial operations. Other private Jewish banking houses may be named as follows: Speyer & Company, J&W Seligman & Company, Lazard Frere, Ladenburg, Tallman & Company, Hallgarten & Company, Knauth, Nakad, and Kuhn, Goldman Sachs & Company, as well as others of relatively less prominence. These firms enjoy a high reputation for financial integrity. They are cautious bankers, skillful in their operations, and sometimes brilliant in their financial strategy. There is much control of industry from the financial side, represented by Jewish power in Wall Street, and they have gained a monopoly of many metal markets. Large, prosperous Jewish brokerage houses are on every hand. The further one goes down the line of speculative operations, the more of the Jewish race one finds to be active in the work of company promotions and the marketing of oil and mineral stocks. Yet one amazing fact stands out from the mass. There is not at this writing a Jewish bank president on Wall Street, that is, a president of a bank of public deposit. Of all the great banks of public deposit and corporation finance, the enormous trust companies whose individual resources often run up to $400 million and whose combined resources approximate many billions, not one of them has a Jewish management or Jewish officers. Why is this so? Why have the powerful banking families of Wall Street surrounded themselves so carefully with non-Jewish associates? Why has this great dividing line been drawn between members of the Jewish and the non-Jewish races in the financial district that manages the financial resources of the nation? Why? The answer to the question is in the custody of the stronger and sounder financial heads of Wall Street. Only here and there will one discover a Jewish director in the boards of some of the lesser banking institutions. The situation may be due to a shrewd analysis of the public mind. Rightly or wrongly, the public prefers not to confide its money to an institution under Jewish control. It is true that in certain uptown sections of New York, there are a few banks of a local character which are completely under Jewish management, but even the Jews prefer to deposit their money in banks which are free of Jewish control. The situation may also be the effect of the unfortunate experience which the public has had with Jewish management of banks in the past. Several large failures have served to impress upon the public mind a certain peculiarity which attached to the Jewish element in those failures. The public has not forgotten, among others, the failure of Joseph G. Robin, whose real name was Robanovich. He was an Odessa Jew. In an incredibly short space of time, he built up four large banking institutions in which public money was deposited. He wrecked them all. Early Madoff, I guess. His failure was most sensational and caused untold suffering. Robanovich's career illustrated very vividly the extent of the gifts and energies of the Jew from Russia, his wonderful faculty for building up large concerns through chicanery, and his cowardice and duplicity in the hour of defeat. This banking career ended in a felon's cell. However, one fact of importance, a fact that should be reassuring to the general public, is that the men to whom is entrusted the crucial task of putting to work and keeping at work the financial resources of the U.S. have hedged themselves about with a non-Jewish wall of great and long standing. The effort of the Jewish interest to gain control of the stock exchange is also an interesting story. And although the record shows a steady Jewish gain toward the end they desire, it is slow. But there are indications that the relentless persistence for which the Jew is noted will prevail in the end. That is, if stock gambling continues to prove an alluring source of wealth. So again, we're seeing what we saw in the F. Scott Fitzgerald novels, that Jews are growing in power. They're very persistent. They flock to where the people are. They flock to where the money is. They don't live off the land. They don't produce things. They are middlemen, or they are people who make their living off people. When the Jews gain control of the stock exchange, they will, for the first time, possess the power to wrest public banking control from the non-Jewish group. And again, they will have set up the Federal Reserve not long before in order to monopolize, cartelize the banking industry so that they can counterfeit for their own benefit, feed their people at Goldman Sachs and these other places. There is a silent resistance to the Jews on the stock exchange also in virtue of an unwritten law, just as there is in the world of the banking world of Wall Street, and the story of the counter-resistance calls for an historian. Okay, so Jews come into the power, they come into the country, but some of the sharpest minds are always going to be in anywhere where there's speculation or money, Goy or Jew, and so there already is a power on Wall Street, and it is subtly, silently resisting Jews, and they had not yet taken over when this was written in 1920, but we're going to hear the story now. He's going to talk about the history of resistance to the Jewish takeover of the stock exchange. It is related by Sereno S. Pratt, S-E-R-E-N-O, that in 1792 there was a little office at number 22 Wall Street for the public sale of stocks. A number of men engaged in the business of buying and selling were accustomed to meet near a large buttonwood tree which stood near 68 Wall Street. In 1817, the New York Stock Exchange, about as present constituted, was organized. So the New York Stock Exchange was organized in 1817. The Stock Exchange is a private institution. It is practically a commission club in private hands. It is not incorporated. Of course, that's all different now because you have the rise of incredible supersizing of the federal government and the rise of all these bureaucracies, which are, of course, then captured by the people they're supposed to be regulating. Its membership is strictly limited to 1,100 men. There are only two ways by which an outsider can become an owner of a seat on the exchange: by obtaining it from the executor of a deceased member, or by purchasing from a retiring or bankrupt member. These memberships, or seats, cost at present more than $100,000. About 10 years ago, a seat could be bought for $77,000. The stock exchange is ruled by a governing committee of 40 members. For many years, no Jew was elected to this committee. Of recent years, an occasional Jewish broker has succeeded in being admitted to this upper group, but not often. This position, however, has not been the main objective of Jewish traders. When they secure a sufficient number of seats on the exchange, they will take care of the matter of control in their own well-known way. The two barriers which at present operate to prevent a large inroad of Jews are these. First, a silent resistance on the part of the other members against the admission of Jews, a resistance which is said to date from the earliest formation of the famous trading institution. And second, the restrictions which are placed by the constitution of the stock exchange itself on all applications for membership. The governing committee of 40 has a committee on admissions which comprises 15 members and which considers all applications for membership. As the membership is fixed at 1,100 and as no new seats are ever sold, a new member can gain entrance only through the transfer of an existing seat, but even such a transfer is under the strict control of the Committee of Admissions, to whose scrutiny the name of the applicant must be submitted, and whose two-thirds approval is necessary to his being seated. So two-thirds of them have to vote for this person to get in, so it's hard to get in. But one outstanding characteristic of the Jewish race is its persistence. What it cannot attain this generation, it will attain next. Defeat it today, it does not remain defeated. Its conquerors die, but Jewry goes on, never forgiving, never deviating from its ancient aim of world control in one form or another. So though it would seem impossible that Jewish membership in the stock exchange could increase under these conditions, the plain fact is that it has increased. Slowly but surely, the Jews are gaining numerical power on the floor of the exchange, and they are doing it with a subtlety that is amazing. How do they do it? In the first place, no Jewish member ever transfers a seat to a non-Jew. In times of market dullness, when the prices of seats drop and the demand is not so keen as usual, Jewish bidders offer, invariably, the highest sums to the seller. Then, in the case of the bankruptcy of a non-Jewish member, the receiver is almost compelled by the demand of creditors to accept the highest bid for the transfer of his membership, and of course a Jew is always at hand to make the bid as high as necessary. These are the two principal methods by which Jewish membership in the exchange is being increased. Another method, however, is more insidious than all the others combined. It is based on the rather common practice of adopting non-Jewish names or professing some phase of the Christian faith. The changed name, or as the Jews know it, the cover name, is a very potent part of the policy of concealment. In an advertisement on business stationery at the head of a magazine or a newspaper article, names such as Smith, Adams, Robin serve as a blind. The stage is flooded with Jewish actors and actresses, but their names are very distinguished Anglo-Saxon. Jewish papers often print jokes based on this habit of changing names. For long-distance dealing or any business that is carried on unsight and unseen, the name veil is very useful. On this account, many Gentiles would be surprised to learn the extent to which they are involved with Jews whose names give no indication of Jewishness. And this very system, an old American name coupled with membership in some Christian sect, preferably one of the newer sects, has accounted for some memberships in the stock exchange which probably would not exist otherwise. It is interesting to tabulate the growth of Jewish membership as shown by the old directories of the exchange. In the year 1872, with a total of 1,009 members, there were 60 Jews. 1873, total of 1,006 members, Jewish membership decreased to 49. 1890, there were 87 Jews, 1,100 total members. In 1893, with the same limit of membership, 1,100, there were 106 Jews. At the present time, still with the same rigid limitation of membership, there are 276 Jewish members. It is said that the Jewish membership is really somewhat larger than the last figures indicate, owing to the fact that some of the Jewish members bear non-Jewish names and have adopted some phase of the Christian faith and have cut themselves off, at least outwardly, from the Jewish community. The figures show, therefore, that the Jewish membership increased from 5 7/8% of the total in 1872 to 25% in 1919. In its reference to the stock exchange under the head of finance, the Jewish Encyclopedia states that Jewish membership is only 128, a little more than 10%. The date of these Jewish statistics is not given. The article quoted has, however, an argumentative as well as informative purpose. The statement concerning the 10% membership on the exchange is made to call attention to the fact that, quote, Jews form at least 20% of the whole population of New York, and much more than that percentage of the business section. The Jewish population of New York City has increased to 25% of the whole, and membership on the stock exchange has increased to the same point. But it has taken 47 years for the Jews to gain that 25% membership. Their control of the exchange, at the given rate of progress, is only a question of time. In spite of these details, it is probably a fact that the Jewish speculators in the New York financial district greatly outnumber the non-Jewish speculators. Speculating and gambling are known historically as special propensities of the Jewish race. While many Jews patronize non-Jewish firms, the great mass of them follow in the speculative path of the leaders of their race. In Europe, where their financial control is more firmly fixed and of longer standing than here, it is rarely that the Jews are caught in speculative failure. They are sometimes found in speculative scandals, but seldom in any scandal involving losses to themselves. As a rule, they dabble in Jewish securities. And in Wall Street, one hears many stories concerning the victories or defeats of the Jewish following. Some of the biggest Jewish sensations which ever occurred in the United States, sensations which disclosed by their lurid light the interlocking of Jewish finance, politics, and racial objectives, have been brought to light by occurrences in Wall Street. It is probably the nature of these disclosures which accounts for the strong and silent anti-Jewish resistance which characterizes straight American finance. Meanwhile, to leave the exalted sphere of Wall Street, banking, and brokerage activities, let us descend to the street level of the curb market in Broad Street. Here, the Jewish brokers flourish in their oil, mining, and stock promotion offices. They are so numerous as to give a Semitic cast to the vicinity as if it were a quarter in a foreign city. It is true that these concerns are frequently operated under non-Jewish names, but that is merely part of the Jew's consciousness that, in financial matters, whether rightly or wrongly, he is under suspicion. Gentile names carry with them no such handicap. Think of the Wolf of Wall Street, and, you know, they have Leo DiCaprio, a goy, playing a guy who was in reality a Jew. And in that movie, he adopts a very old Anglo-Saxon sounding name, sounds the very model of rectitude and probity, in order to hide his shenanigans. Sell it to old idiots. Going still further down the line, in shadier lanes and in semi-hidden offices, now think boiler room, I suppose, may be seen numerous members of the Jewish race who are identified with no established market which deals with securities. These are the true parasites of the Wall Street environment. They are the camp followers without status. Their work is that of fraudulent stock promotion, the boiler room, and they enter upon it with a zeal and an energy which nothing can dismay. Their purpose is to make money without labor, to get money without giving any value, and in this they are immensely successful. It is amazing the number of these men who make immense fortunes. It is equally amazing the continuous crop of unwary, poorly informed, and unsuspecting Gentiles who send their money from all parts of the U.S. for the worthless bits of paper in which these Jewish parasites deal. It is a most heartless business. It has not even brilliance in its deviltry. It is the old-time shell game, in other terms. The operations of these men are mostly conducted by mail or telephone. They deal in sucker lists. They circulate market letters by which, under the pretense of giving disinterested advice to investors, they seek to promote their own shady game. These market letters are, of course, innocuous, harmless to those who are informed and who can read their fraudulent import between the lines, but they are dangerous to the honest but uninformed minds of tens of thousands of thrifty people. Pursued by detective agencies, watched constantly by government secret service, exposed by the newspapers and placed on trial in the courts, convicted and sentenced to terms in prison, this type of Jewish swindler is undeterred. Where other men would regard exposure as a lifelong shame, this type regards it as simply a trifling interruption, as a sailor would regard an accidental tumble overboard. There are lower depths still, where bald theft and violence prevail. The persons most found there are the henchmen of the lower type of speculators. The stories of this was where you get into the actual mafia. The stories of criminality in Wall Street, a numerous and startling list, involving sometimes the high but mostly the low, and all marked with a peculiar racial and groupal cast, have at times challenged the attention of the whole world, but as is usually the case with the general publication of such stories, the fundamental explanatory facts are omitted. But it will be seen, as the story of actual conditions in Wall Street and its financial environments is unrolled, that there are always two elements, Jewish and non-Jewish. It is perhaps the only non-Jewish coalition in America, this silent resistance which American finance is making to Semitic control. That's interesting. He's saying this group of resistors is perhaps the only non-Jewish coalition in America. It is, in a sense, unnatural to the American mind, but has been forced as a defensive against the strong offensive operations of the Semitic coalition. Just as I always say, Jews operate as a team. We need a Team White hashtag, Team White, to resist them. There's no other way to do it. If there is ever in the United States a strong non-Jewish combination, and that was a big word they used to mean all people working together versus the individual, it will be the direct result of the ancient Jewish coalition against non-Jews. Important sentence. If there is ever in the United States a strong non-Jewish combination, it will be the direct result of the ancient Jewish coalition against non-Jews. The condition in the United States at this moment with regard to the financial question is this. The Jewish coalition goes lower, but it does not yet go higher than non-Jewish control. It is struggling to go higher, but has thus far been stopped. It is believed that when the people are made aware of what is transpiring, it will be forever stopped. Well, that proved wrong. Mere exposure proved not enough. As readers of former articles will remember, the attack upon capital represented by the disorderly forces who operate under the forged banner of progress is an attack against Gentile capital only. The only financial managers attacked in the United States are Gentile managers. In England also the same attack is made. Readers of the newspapers know what strenuous efforts are being made in that country to wreck railroad and coal mine administration by a constant series of strikes. But what readers of the newspapers are not told is that the railroad and coal mines are still in Gentile hands, and that the Bolshevist-led strike is a Jewish financial weapon to wreck these Gentile forms of business, that they may easily fall into Jewish hands. And that marks the end of chapter 23, published in the Dearborn Independent, issue of 13 November 1920. So, Jews, Wall Street existed before Jews got to the U.S. Jews got here, and although there were a lot of restrictions against getting onto the boards, they slowly and persistently kept at it, so that by the time the article was written in 1919, or the data taken for the article from 1919, all right, so this was again written in November of 1920, so we see the history of Wall Street, that it was founded by non-Jews, and Jews came in after 1880, started moving on to the board and tried to get through. They made it difficult. They were resisted. They still were not preponderant, that is, dominant, at the time of the writing, but they acceded to complete dominance after that. Now move on to chapter 24, The High and Low of Jewish Money Power. Begins with an epigraph from the protocols that we've talked about in earlier recordings. Anyway, economic crises were created for us by the Gentiles only by the withdrawal of money from circulation. The present issue of money does not coincide with the need per capita and consequently it cannot satisfy all the needs of the working classes. You know that gold currency was detrimental to the governments that accepted it, for it could not satisfy the requirements of money, since we took as much gold as possible out of circulation. Protocol 20. The High and Low of Jewish Money Power. Jewish high finance first touched the U.S. through the Rothschilds. I always can never get Rothschilds or Rothschilds. Indeed, it may be said that the United States founded the Rothschild fortune. And, as so often occurs in the tale of Jewish riches, the fortune was founded in war. The first $20 million the Rothschilds ever had to speculate with was the money paid for Hessian troops to fight against the American colonies. That's interesting. Since that first indirect connection with American affairs, the Rothschilds have often invaded the money affairs of the country, though always by agents. None of the Rothschild sons thought it necessary to establish himself in the United States. Anselm remained in Frankfurt. Solomon chose Vienna. Nathan Meyer went to London. Charles established himself in Naples. And James represented the family in Paris. These were the five warlords of Europe, for more than a generation, and their dynasty was continued by their successors. The first Jewish agent of the Rothschilds in the United States was August Belmont, who came to the U.S. in 1837 and was made chairman of the Democratic National Committee at the outbreak of the Civil War. The Belmonts professed Christianity, and there is today a Belmont memorial called the Oriental Chapter in the new Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Morningside Heights. Rothschild power, as it was once known, has been so broadened by the entry of other banking families into governmental finance that it must now be known not by the name of one family of Jews, but by the name of the race. Thus, it is spoken of as international Jewish finance, and its principal figures are described as international Jewish financiers. Much of the veil of secrecy which contributed so greatly to the Rothschild power has been stripped away. War finance has been labeled for all time as blood money, and the mysterious magic surrounding large transactions between government and individuals, by which individual controllers of large wealth were made the real rulers of the people, has been largely stripped away and the plain facts exposed or disclosed. The Rothschild method still holds good, however, in that Jewish institutions are affiliated with their racial institutions in all foreign countries. There are Jewish banking firms in New York whose connections with firms in Frankfurt, Hamburg, and Dresden, as well as in London and Paris, can be traced by the mere matter of the signs over the doors. They are one. As a leading student of financial affairs puts it, the world of high finance is largely a Jewish world because of the Jewish financiers' absence from national or patriotic illusions. To the international Jewish financier, the ups and downs of war and peace between nations are but the changes of the world's financial market, and as frequently the movement of stocks is manipulated for the purposes of market strategy, so sometimes international relations are affected for mere financial gain. It is known that the recent Great War was postponed several times at the behest of international financiers. If it broke out too soon, it would not involve the states which the international financiers wish to involve. Therefore, the masters of gold, that is, the international masters, were compelled several times to check the martial enthusiasm which their own propaganda had aroused. It is probably quite true, as the Jewish press alleges, that there has been discovered a Rothschild letter dated 1911 and urging the Kaiser against war. The year 1911 was too early. There was no such insistence in 1914. Not only do these foreign financial affiliations cast a different light on purely national matters affecting the peace and prestige of the peoples, but they tend toward an extra or supranationality. When these foreign affiliations enable Jewish bankers to excel in the more highly specialized forms of finance, such as foreign exchange, they also enable them to exercise almost complete control over international money movements. There is no question whatever of international Jewish finance being deeply concerned in matters of war and revolution. This is never denied as to the past, but it is just as true of the present. The League Against Napoleon, for example, was Jewish. Its headquarters were in Holland. When Napoleon invaded Holland, the headquarters were moved to Frankfurt on the Main. It is remarkable how many of the international Jewish financiers have come out of Frankfurt. The Rothschilds, the Schiffs, the Spires, to name but a few. The racial affiliations running all through the world of international finance are readily recognized. These associations produce in Jewish banking circles a constant tendency toward control or monopoly of certain lines of industry, which are identified with the fields of finance. The rule is, once control is gained, all non-Jewish interests must be driven out. Jewish financial interests have rarely been concerned with industrials, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, except as regards some of the precious stones and metals, the Rothschilds controlling mercury, Barnato Brothers and Werner, Biden Company Diamonds, and the firms of Lewison Brothers and Guggenheim Sons controlling copper, and to some extent silver. To this, of course, may be added whiskey, wireless, theaters, the European press, and part of the American in a number of other fields. The list will be made complete in this series of articles before they are finished. The Jewish Encyclopedia continues. It is, however, mainly in the direction of foreign loans that there has been any definite predominance of Jewish financiers, this being due, as before stated, to the international relations of the larger Jewish firms. In order that the senseless denials of certain portions of the Jewish press may be checked, it may be said that the Jewish authorities do not deny such statements as are made about Jewish international financial control, although they declare it is not as strong as it once was. Of more recent years, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, non-Jewish financiers have learned the same cosmopolitan method, and, on the whole, the control is now rather less than more in Jewish hands than formerly. That is true at least so far as the United States is concerned. Previous to the war, the status of many of the Jewish financial concerns in Wall Street was stronger than it is now. The war brought about a condition which threw a new light on the internationalism of Jewish finance. During the years of American neutrality, there was opportunity to observe the extent of the foreign affiliations of certain men, and also the extent to which ordinary national loyalty was subordinated to the business of international finance. The war really forced a coalition of Gentile capital on one side of the struggle, as against certain blocks of Jewish capital, which were willing to play both sides. The old Rothschild maxim, "Do not put all your eggs in one basket," becomes perfectly plain when transposed into national and international terms. Jewish finance treats political parties the same, bets on them both, and so never loses. In the same way, Jewish finance never loses a war. Being on both sides, it cannot miss the winning side, and its terms of peace are sufficient to cover all advances to the side that lost. This was the significance of the great swarming of Jews at the peace conference. Many of the Jewish houses on Wall Street were originally American branches of long-established houses in Germany and Austria. These international firms were accustomed to support one another with capital and maintained other intimate associations. Some of them are linked by intermarriage, but the bond above all is the Jewish racial bond. Most of these houses received a severe setback during the war because their overseas associations were not of the right kind. But this setback is expected to be only temporary, and the Jewish financiers will again be ready to give battle for the entire financial control of the United States. Whether they will be successful, the future will decide. But a strange fatality seems to follow all forms of Jewish supremacy. And interesting, the title of David Duke's book here appears as a phrase, Jewish supremacy. Just as the capstone is ready to be placed upon the edifice of Jewish triumphs, something occurs and the structure shrinks. It occurs so often in Jewish history that the Jews themselves have been exercised to find an explanation. In many cases, anti-Semitism offers a ready excuse, but not always. Just at the present time, when the light was shed, which was shed by the fires of war, has revealed so many matters formerly hidden in shadow, the awakening of the world attention is called anti-Semitism, and the explanation is given that, quote, after every war, the Jew becomes a scapegoat. A curious admission which would lead a less self-centered people to inquire, why? But so handy and so untrustworthy an explanation as anti-Semitism does not account for the failure of Jewish financial interests to become absolutely dominant in a country like the U.S. Anti-Semitism among the people does not surge high enough to injure those securely entrenched behind great financial influence. The silent resistance of the Wall Street Financial Group, or of the New York Stock Exchange, for example, is not anti-Semitism. It is not a hindrance to the Jews in doing business. It is opposition to an apparent program of total control, which is sought not for the general good, but for a racial benefit. It was only a few years ago that the banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was commonly referred to as being destined in the near future to win complete financial supremacy in Wall Street as an underwriting and money-lending institution. There were many reasons for this belief, among them the fact that Kuhn, Loeb & Company were the financial backers of Harriman in his terrific railroad duel with James J. Hill, but the prophecy regarding this financial institution was never realized. Untoward events intervened, in no way affecting the financial integrity of the firm, but bringing it into the light of undesirable publicity, not of a financial character. In the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company, Jewish finance in the U.S. reached its high watermark. The head of this firm was the late Jacob Schiff, who was born in Frankfurt on the Main and whose father was one of the Rothschilds' brokers. One of Jacob Schiff's associates, Otto Kahn, was born in Mannheim and was early associated with the Spires, who also originated in Frankfurt on the Main. Another associate, Felix Warburg, married into Jacob Schiff's family. That's the one that Al Gore's daughter married into. The one, again, that financed Lenin and Trotsky and their communist revolution. Felix Warburg married into that family. Jewish finance has spread, but it has not risen higher than in this firm. So Schiff, head of Kuhn. A flank movement, however, has been attempted, which may bring Jewish ambitions nearer the goal of their desire. Checked in Wall Street, Jewish financiers have sought out other American centers and even foreign centers whose future influence on American affairs promises to be considerable. The first flank movement is towards Central and South America. It may be said that the financial assistance, practical and advisory, offered to Mexico during the most unsatisfactory period of her relations with the United States was given by Jewish financial groups. The attempt to gain influence with Japan seems to have come off rather badly. It is known, of course, that Jacob Schiff gave material assistance to Japan in her war with Russia. This was explainable on the ground of good business, and also of a desire to revenge Russia's treatment of the Jews. Mr. Schiff used the opportunity also to instill the principles which have since grown up into Bolshevism into the minds of Russian prisoners in Japanese war camps. But more than that, the idea appears to have been to add to the newly rising Japanese power to the string of Jewish financial conquests. Jewish finance already has a foothold in Japan, but it appears that Mr. Schiff's hopes in this respect were not fully realized. The Japanese are credited with knowing much more about, quote, the Jewish peril than even the United States does, and they were exceedingly wary. They kept the business deal strictly a business deal, and Mr. Schiff was said to have been displeased with Japan generally. This is well worth knowing at this time, especially in view of the propaganda, which seeks constantly to cause misunderstandings to arise between the United States and the Empire of Japan. But South America appears to be the latest objective. It must be remembered that the Jews exercise world control in two departments, in movements of men and in movements of money. No government, no church, no school of thought could order the movement of 250,000, half a million, or even a million people from one part of the world to another, shifting them as a general shifts his army. But the Jews can do that. They are doing that now. It is only a matter of ships from Poland, where Jewish special privileges have been written into the law of the land by the all-powerful peace conference, and where it would seem that the Jews have every reason to remain, there is a great movement westward. It is not a stampede, as the American Commissioner of Immigration says, although it may look so from this side. It is an orderly movement, as can be seen where the American Jewish directors on the other side are observed, when they're observed, and part of it is being directed to South America. It is said that after a period of training in the United States, some of the immigrants who are now landing here will be shipped south again. This other mastery which the Jews exert in a world degree is that over the movement of gold. Without giving expression to what the purpose may be, there is this to be said. A large movement of Jewish men and Jewish gold proceeds towards South America these days, and there is to be said a large movement of other materials which, when interpreted by the protocols, can mean but one thing. The next attempt for control of the Americas may come from the South, where the Jews are already stronger than their numbers would indicate, and where their revolutionary proclivities have already come into play as between various states. These rebuffs and these strategic flank maneuvers or movements do not, however, complete the record. We are now speaking of American finance only. The Jews have not been restrained elsewhere as they have been in Wall Street. They exercise a very ominous control in a number of other fields, each of which will be taken up in detail in due time. For the present, our attention is being directed to New York and its financial district. We have just shown the high watermark of Jewish control as it has been reached up to the date in the street. There is another aspect of Jewish influence on the financial affairs of America which is not so flattering to that race. If Jewish financial activity does not go higher, it goes lower and finds its way into darker channels than does any other form of financial activity in this country. So Jews have achieved the high end, but not completely. They're somewhat shut out of the high end, although persistent and growing in presence there over time, but they completely dominate the low end, the loan shark end. It would make a sordid tale, the operations of the Robins, the Lamars, the Arnsteins, and the others who have contributed to the long roll of criminality produced within the shadow of Wall Street. And the only point that could be served by its retelling is that such criminality is predominantly Jewish. He's talking about boiler rooms and loan sharking. This is not to say that it has the approval of the Jewish community, but it is very significant that while whole volumes of abuse have been heaped upon the Dearborn Independent's very modest effort to state the status of the Jewish question in America, the leaders of Jewry have been silent about the criminal financial operations of those who could be made to feel the displeasure of their race. The Jewish passion for the defense of the race, regardless of the degree of guilt, is well known to every prosecuting attorney. Although it must be said that during the investigation made some years ago, which revealed the business of commercialized vice to be under Jewish control, certain public-spirited Jews commendably aided the work. This aid, however, did not prevent the severest opposition to certain publications which gave notice of the facts that the investigators were finding. This country, was lately astounded by the revelation that stocks in Liberty Bonds to the value of $12 million had been lost through a systematic series of thefts in Wall Street. Beginning with the spring of 1918, messengers sent out by the New York Stock Exchange firms to make deliveries of stocks and bonds to other houses in the course of ordinary business began to disappear as if the earth had swallowed them up. For a time, these disappearances were without explanation. Wall Street is really a small district. Most of its business is done within the space of a city block. Messengers on their trip sometimes went only to another floor in the same building or to an office across the street. Yet in these short trips, they would disappear with all their securities, seldom to be heard of again. Up to the summer of 1918, the absconding messenger boy was a rarity. The type was regarded with good-humored indulgence on the street. They were generally happy-go-lucky youngsters, and the steadier heads among them graduated into clerks of the commission houses. The labor shortage struck Wall Street along with other sections of the country, and messenger boys were difficult to find. During this period, there was also a great expansion in business. Nearly everyone in the country possessed bonds of some kind, and these changed hands in unparalleled quantities. On the floor of the stock exchange, daily transactions in bonds up to $20 million and in stocks up to 1 or 2 million shares were common. Following the sales, the stocks and bonds were transferred from seller to buyer by messenger boy. It was not unusual for irresponsible lads to be running from office to office in Wall Street with $250,000 each under the arms. Then, with the shortage of boys, another type of messenger began to appear, and with this type, trouble began. Disappearances and losses became more frequent and costly. The indemnities paid by the insurance companies reached such staggering figures that the custom of issuing blanket insurance was withdrawn. Various expedients were adopted to solve the mystery. Boys were required to travel in pairs. Guards were posted throughout Wall Street. The best detectives in the land were assigned to the matter, but without avail. There was a strong disinclination in Wall Street toward publishing the figures of the losses for fear the publication might be destructive of public confidence in the street's financial condition. But the news was known in the underworld and drew to New York criminals from all parts of the country. For a time, all efforts were fruitless. The losses continued and the mystery deepened. Then suddenly, in the early part of 1920, certain arrests were made and confessions obtained, which disclosed one of the most amazing criminal conspiracies in the history of the United States. There was proved the existence of a vast Jewish conspiracy to loot Wall Street. It was found that a band of astute Jewish criminals, many of them wealthy men, some of them ex-convicts, had created an organization by which Wall Street financial houses were to be plundered. Bands of young Jews, mostly of Russian origin and living on the East Side, had been shaped into being. These lads, instructed by clever Jewish principals, applied to Wall Street messenger agencies for employment in brokerage houses. It was part of the plan for them to assume good, honest-sounding Anglo-Saxon names, the cover name, in quotes, how often we meet it. These lads turned over their stolen stocks and bonds to the heads of their organizations, who in turn passed the securities on to the Jewish principals, who were for the most part members of the criminal band of confidence men in the White Light District, the, quote, bankroll men, unquote, whose immunity from punishment has always been one of the standing puzzles of Gentiles residing in New York. These Jewish criminals were aided by Jewish lawyers in their transactions. The stolen stocks and bonds were taken to Cleveland, Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, and parts of Canada, where they were pledged as collateral for loans in an apparently legitimate course of business. One of the messenger boys refused to deliver his stolen securities for the small sum he was offered for them and ran away to enjoy his ill-gotten wealth. His hiding place was discovered, and a band of Harlem assassins were sent for him with instructions to find where his securities went. If they were on the boy's person, he was to be killed at once. This band entertained the boys with drinks and women for several days until they learned that his securities were sewed inside the lining of his coat. They took him for a joyride into the country, and his dead body was found afterwards, typically slain with about 24 dagger wounds in his body. In one instance, a non-Jew was inveigled into the nefarious scheme, and the method was also typical. The Jewish principals wished for another clearinghouse through which to dispose of their securities and were tipped off that a young non-Jewish broker was on the verge of bankruptcy. He was helped out and given what appeared to him to be a very profitable piece of business. Once in the power of his friends and deeply entangled in their game, he tried to get out of it. He was threatened with death. The Jewish principal said to him, "I don't want any double-crossing here or I'll kill you in a minute. If I can't do it, if I'm locked up, there are plenty of my gang who will do it." Upon the arrest and confession of this non-Jew, many of the Jewish principals fled New York, traveling as usual under their assumed Christian names. But their identity had at last become known, and although many of their messenger boy dupes had been made to suffer the penalty for their crimes, the leaders at this writing yet free, and the most powerful influences seemed to be invoked to protect them from the ordinary operations of the law. A few have been captured, but although their accusers are still the most powerful banking, brokerage, and surety companies on Wall Street, a power greater still seems to defend them from the treatment usually accorded known criminals. One of the ringleaders has defied the courts with impunity and still walks the streets. Jewish theatrical managers in New York have headlined his actress wife, a Jewess, presumably because of the added prestige it gave her to be the wife of the world-defying bond thief. That is the element which strikes something like a consternation to the heart of the ordinary lover of law and order, the insolence with which these wealthy Jewish criminals regard all the agencies of the law. They are defended by clever lawyers, and the attitude of the Jewish press and the Jewish population toward them is compact of sympathy and admiration. Well, why not? Since most of the individual victims of the thievery are Gentiles, and the general victim is Gentile capitalism itself. There is complete silence on the Jewish side regarding this reign of crime. And yet, inevitably, the Jews themselves must suffer from most of it. or must suffer most from it. The New York Kehila has completely ignored this outbreak and its exposure. The spokesmen of Jewry, so voluble against non-Jews, have no word to say to those whom they would probably call their co-religionists. Yet it is well enough understood that so closely combined are all the influences in New York Jewry that a determined effort on the part of the leaders could clean up many untoward conditions now existing. But there seems to be a distinct aversion to anything that will indicate a division of one class of Jews against another. It is a racial instinct, evidently to protect the threatened one, no matter how richly he may deserve punishment. And that's what we're saying. He's saying Jews band together both on both the criminal side and both the racial self-defense side. It's the same as with Leo Frank in a non-financial matter. They band together as one to defend their guiltiest member, someone who raped and murdered a little girl. They band together as one to defend Jewish financial criminals. It is a racial instinct, evidently, to protect the threatened one, no matter how richly he may deserve punishment. That's why you don't want to have any dealings with them, and we need to fight them off as a team white. It is this fact which put the finishing Jewish touch on the whole matter. It may, of course, be an accident that all the criminals and their tools, with an occasional exception, are Jews. That itself might not be a reason in the extreme sense for labeling the condition with a racial name, but the silence, the approbation in some quarters, the very active sympathy in others, all combining as a racial protectorate around the wrongdoers, is the more regrettable manifestation of the two. A Jew will side with a Jew criminal against an honest goy. And that's really all you need to know. They're thick as thieves because they are thieves, and they are thick because they're blood-related. They're a criminal genetic clan. They hate Gentiles. Their anti-Gentilism is an inherent portion of their, part of their heritage. And it is their entire culture. They hate Goyim far more than they even like themselves. But they're criminals, and their rise or their fall together. Anyway, that chapter about Jewish financiers and Jewish financial criminals was appeared in Dearborn Independent on the 20th of November, 1920. So, we made it through chapter 23 and chapter 24, and we will pick up soon again with more in volume 2 of the 4-volume Unabridged, The International Jew. I want to thank you for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.